Douglas Arnold Heine versus Deutsche Bank National Trust Company et al. May I please the court, Mr. John Young will argue for the appellant. Mr. Michael Roy will argue for Deutsche Bank National Trust Company as trustee in Bank of America. Mr. Matthew H. Davis will argue for Select Portfolio Services.
Hi. Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm John Nels. I represent Douglas Hines, the appellant in this case. I do appreciate, let me say at the outset, I appreciate the opportunity to orally argue this. You initially had denied us oral argument. We objected to it, and you were kind enough to listen to our objection. And so I'm really going to initially just hit on that, because I think that obviously was something that got the court's attention, where otherwise you thought maybe argument wouldn't be helpful. In this case,
Not to throw you off base, but if at any time we deny argument and the counsel asks us for it, we always grant it.
Oh, okay.
So it's court policy.
I see. Well, thank you anyway. In this particular case, we filed, without going into all the matters in the case, we filed a motion for a new trial because of newly discovered evidence. The hearing in this, the summary judgments was in July the 10th. On August the 4th, my client learned for the first time, because he received a notice from a Florida federal court involving the same parties that were involved in this case, Bank of America, Countrywide, that he might be a part of a class action. And what it was based on in the Florida case, when we checked on it, we found that it was based on pretty flagrant fraud that we didn't know anything about. And part of it was similar to what we had in that my client was required to take forced hazard insurance. That's what occurred in Florida. What came out in the Florida case that we had no idea about is that they had found fraud in the part of Bank of America and its affiliates, in that what it had done is it was the affiliate, Balboa Insurance Company, who was also involved in this case, was actually owned by Countrywide. And what they were doing is doing kickbacks and between the two companies, and in addition to that, charging 2 to 20 times the cost of insurance. So what we found is more egregious acts that we had no knowledge of at the time that we handle a summary judgment. What they effectively did, at least is what was argued in the Florida court, is that they changed the amount of the mortgage because they increased it by increasing more money involved. Well, we had no way of knowing that. We've got to show four things, as far as I know, on a motion for a new trial. One is that we didn't know about it, and we didn't, and we showed that it came several weeks after the time that the hearing was had. There wasn't any way that my client could have known about that. I think it was hinted at one of the hearings that perhaps we could have asked, I guess, Bank of America, what other fraudulent acts have you committed on my client, which I think would have probably been objected to. But what we have found since that time, I have recently done research. I have found 40 sites nationwide involving Bank of America, Deutsche Bank, and Countrywide. One was entitled America Lost, Bank of America, Deutsche Bank, and Countrywide. What we also discovered, which we brought up in our motion for new trial, is that the Department of Justice had sanctioned Bank of America and these parties for $17 billion, which was the largest single sanction in the entire United States history, plus they had been hit for another $9 billion in regard to paying back consumer loans. And now we found
Counsel,
it's...
Counsel, let's get to the arguments in this sure. case, okay?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, what we believe, Your Honor, is that when we found these facts that are not cumulative but separate acts of fraud, we asked the court for the opportunity to for a new trial so, one, we could conduct discovery. Two, so we could have a fair hearing. We're talking about constitutional dimensions. That's what we believe we've been denied by the denial of the motion for a new trial. In this case, what we had involved, just very briefly in facts, is my client had some water damage in 2006. He paid out $28,820 out of his pocket, repaired the thing. There was force-placed hazard insurance. He was told by Countrywide that, and this is all in his affidavit, and this is what we presented in regard to summary judgment evidence, that what he should do is make a claim on the policy for reimbursement, not because he's named as an insured on the policy, not because of that he was suing under the policy, but that he had a claim for reimbursement. He did that. They sent out adjusters. Adjusters did their thing. He did everything that Countrywide told him to do. Subsequently, he learned that they had simply pocketed the money and they did not reimburse him. He made a demand for return or reimbursement of the money.
Well, does their contract provide that they have to reimburse him?
The contract doesn't, but one of the cases that was cited by my opponents, which is totally distinguishable, is called Garcia. In that case, they did what you're talking about. Garcia, in that case, filed as a third-party beneficiary on suing under the contract of insurance. He lost. The court said that you don't have a right to do that. They distinguished out that sort of thing. That's not what we're doing here. What we're really talking about whenever they say there's their duty is that they were unjustly enriched, and I've cited that in my brief. When someone takes money that someone else is entitled to or should be paid in terms of reimbursement, there the unjust enrichment takes place, and there is a quasi-contractual duty under that according to the case law.
But how could they be unjustly enriched when they were the ones who purchased the policy?
Because the policy was a hazard policy for repairs of the items securing the loan. They didn't repair it. My client did. They did absolutely nothing except just take the money. They also represented to my client that they would pay him back. They would reimburse him. That's so he did. He made a claim for reimbursement. They didn't do that. They simply pocketed the money and kept it. Where it became significant is there was a period of time in 2007 until they filed their initial 726 action, when my client was in China and had been injured, was not working, and had not made payments. What we presented was summary judgment evidence that had he been reimbursed the $28,820, there would have been no default. There would have been no basis. Either one, he could have paid it with the money, or two, if they had simply credited it to his account, there would have been no default. So there would have been no basis to the thing to begin with. We, in the original 726 case, we filed the same responses that we did in this lawsuit. What occurred, because as you know, under 726, it's simply a matter of affidavits, no testimony, and they get to do their thing. I had to file a separate lawsuit in order to stop the 726 action. Now, I might add that in the 726 action, we were required by the 343rd District Court to pay in double payments, which we did. Paid in $19,000 in payment in 1 year before we filed the other case. None of that money was considered by the trial court.
Is it still in the registry of the court?
It is.
And there's been no disposition of that?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what are you asking us to do about that?
Well, what we had asked the trial court to do about that is we had alleged a affirmative defense of payment. We said, and we presented summary judgment evidence to the effect that had you applied the $28,820 that was converted wrongfully by Countrywide, Balboa, Deutsche Bank, and Bank of America subsequently, had you applied that plus the $19,000, there wouldn't have been any default at all. None of that was considered. In fact, in the judgment for closing on my client's house, the court found he owed the entire amount, $240,000-some-odd, with no credit or offset whatsoever. It just wasn't considered. But we had applied, we had used here several different things. We talked about...
But what are you asking us to do with the monies in the registry of the court?
Well,
if anything.
I'm not. I'm not asking you to do anything. I suppose that probably what would happen is that one of the parties will make an application to try to get it at some point, but that hasn't happened. What we're asking for is an opportunity to have our day in court, to have to go back. What we're asking for is a reversal for a new trial in the case. We feel that if we get the opportunity to actually have discovery and go into and find the additional fraudulent acts that have been committed on my client, that that could substantially change the outcome in this case. And we were not permitted to do that. That's why we feel it is constitutional dimensions. We have presented, at least, you know, in regard to the no evidence motion, we presented evidence creating a scintilla of evidence on every point. The only thing that they could come up with is to say, well, you can't show that they had a duty to pay it back. And I just gave you one, unjust enrichment, when there is a quasi-contractual obligation to pay that back. And they didn't do it. They also represented that they would pay it back, and my client did what they said. He preserved the property. He kept the property, securing the loan, intact. All they did was take the money. They didn't apply the proceeds to the hazard insurance to what it was intended to be, which was to protect themselves by keeping the property intact. What they did is simply unjustly enrich themselves by getting my client to pay the money, you know, under the illusion that he's going to be reimbursed, not illusion, by representation that he will be, and then he isn't. And it's not a matter, one of the things that I think that will probably be, that came up in the other hearing, is that they said, well, gee, he had notice that Countrywide was going to get the money because we sent a letter. Well, that was a disputed issue of fact, because there's no proof that my client got any letter. In fact, he testified he never had notice. And I believe under the law, the court was supposed to give some credence or favor his facts, since he was the party that was subject to having a summary judgment against him. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Michael McElroy. I'm going to be addressing the error assigned to the trial court granting summary judgment as to Mr. Hines's claims against the defendants, as well as the court's denial of the motion for a new trial. I think the most primary argument we would make as far as the trial court granting summary judgment on Mr. Hines's claims against the defendants is the court was correct. There was no evidence at all that Mr. Hines had an interest in the funds. He was not an insured to the property, so he wasn't entitled to the insurance proceeds. The second argument that we would make is that he didn't bring his claims timely. The evidence shows that the money that was paid, which, by the way, was not $28,000, it was $16,000, but the money that was paid to Countrywide was paid in July of 2006, and Mr. Hines was provided notice that it was paid to Countrywide in July of 2006. If he had a claim to those funds, it accrued in July of 2006, yet he didn't bring this lawsuit until March of 2011. At that point, all he did was sue Deutsche Bank. That was more than 4 years after the money had been paid to Countrywide. And then he didn't sue Bank of America or SPS until May 1st of 2013, almost 7 years after the money was paid to Countrywide. So the court was correct, absolutely, in granting summary judgment, but we have another issue here, and it came up when he appealed the case, and that is waiver. You know, he complains that about the trial court's granting of the no evidence motion for summary judgment, and he insists that he presented evidence on each of the challenged elements. Yet, even if the trial court erred, which we don't believe that it did, that error would be harmless because he never assigns any error to the other grounds that were asserted in our traditional motion for summary judgment. The fact that he wasn't entitled to the funds because he wasn't an insured, and the fact that his claim is barred by limitations. Not once in his opening brief does he mention either the traditional motion for summary judgment on his affirmative claims against the defendants, or even the word limitations doesn't appear. So because the trial court could easily have granted summary judgment on either of those grounds, they independently support the trial court's ruling, he's waived any error that the trial court may have committed, which we don't believe it did, in granting summary judgment on his affirmative claims against us. The next argument that he makes is that the trial court erred in denying the motion for a new trial. And he points to two categories of documents. He's got a couple of internet articles about a Bank of America settlement with the Department of Justice related to the sale of mortgage-backed securities. What he doesn't explain is how that has anything to do with his case. He also presents evidence of the existence of a class action lawsuit in Florida, where we have a copy of the petition, settlement agreement, an order preliminarily granting the settlement agreement, and the notice of the claim, the class settlement claim that he received, Mr. Hines received, allegedly in September of 2014. Well, none of these is evidence that's sufficient to grant him a new trial. First of all, none of that is evidence of any wrongdoing, not in this case or not in any other case. It's simply evidence of allegations made either by the Department of Justice against Bank of America or against plaintiffs and plaintiffs' attorneys in a Florida lawsuit and a settlement of those allegations. Neither the allegations themselves nor the settlement of those allegations, which, by the way, in the class action, the settlement agreement, was expressly done without any admission of wrongdoing or any liability whatsoever. None of that is evidence of any wrongdoing. But even if he could present those documents to show evidence of liability, there's no evidence of liability in this case. The claims asserted in the class action have nothing to do with the claims that Mr. Hines asserted, and I believe in his reply brief and in here today in oral argument, he concedes as much. He's not saying, I want a new trial on the claims that I actually brought. He's saying, I want a new trial so I can conduct some discovery and see what else I might be able to come up with to keep this case alive. I don't believe that that is the standard. I haven't found any authority that says that you can grant a new trial on newly discovered evidence of claims that you have not actually brought. I think the standard is that it has to make a difference in the trial that actually occurred. Another problem with this argument is that it doesn't overcome the reasons why the court properly granted summary judgment in the first place. Nothing about any of the allegations in the Department of Justice settlement or the class action settlement is going to make Mr. Hines an insured or entitle him to any of the claim proceeds. And there's nothing about any of those documents that's going to make his claim timely. The court properly granted summary judgment on those claims for those very reasons. You know, and going back to my point about whether or not he can ask for a new trial to pursue claims that he has not brought and ask for additional discovery. The problem with that claim in this particular case is that if you look at the evidence and the testimony that Mr. Hines gave at the hearing on the motion for a new trial, he became a member of the class settlement. He testified, and this was after the opt-out date. If you look at all the evidence, we've got the settlement agreement itself, and then there's an order which preliminarily grants it. It sets a final hearing date of October 29, 2014, and provides that all claims to opt out must be made by September 29, 2014. And in fact, the notice that Mr. Hines testified he received has the exact same information. Knowing that, on October 24, 2014, at the hearing on the motion for a new trial, Mr. Hines testified that he did believe he was part of the class, did not opt out of it, and intended to make claims about it. So even if they could have this case reopened so that they could have a new trial on the claims that mirror what was brought in the Florida class action, Mr. Hines can't do it. His sole remedy is through the settlement agreement. He specifically released any further claims against Bank of America, and he would not be able to bring them up in this lawsuit. So for all the reasons that we asserted in our briefing, we ask the court overrule any of the Mr. Hines' issues and affirm the trial court summary judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, what about the money in the registry of the court?
I honestly have no idea why they haven't already gotten it. My client doesn't have any claim to it. I don't believe Mr. Davis's client has any claim to it. Mr. Hines, I have no idea why he hasn't gone to the court, submitted a motion, and it'd be granted, and he'd have it.
So you also do not ask us to do anything with those funds?
No, in fact, it's in the 340. It's in the 342nd. It's not in the 153rd. That was okay. In a separate proceeding. So, yeah, I don't know that you could do anything at this point.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Davis?
Thank you. May it please the court, Matthew Davis on behalf of SPS. First of all, just to address your question about the payments into the registry of the court, I would agree with Mr. McElroy that those funds are in the 342nd. I'm not sure that there's anything that this court can do with those funds at this point. I think the fact that those funds are in the court, still in the registry there, underscores that really the purpose of this lawsuit is to allow Mr. Hines to continue residing in a property that he has not made a payment on since 2007. Since 2007, I believe July 2007 is when the loan was due. It was accelerated in that year. During the entire pendency of the action at bar here, those payments remain in the registry of the court. Mr. Hines made no attempt to get those funds out of the registry of the court and have them applied either as a payment or placed in the registry of the 153rd, and only brought those up after the fact in an attempt to argue that a judgment against him for foreclosure would be inappropriate. However, the amount due on the loan that was accelerated in 2008 as of the time of foreclosure is $244,000. So the application, even assuming that Mr. Hines had pulled the funds out of the registry in a timely manner and actually paid them to SPS, which would be a prerequisite to any claim for payment as an affirmative defense, it still would not bar foreclosure because it would not come anywhere near actually paying off the loan. And at this point, since the loan has been accelerated, what is due is the entire balance of the loan, not any lesser amount. So a payment of $19,000 would really have no impact on the foreclosure itself. Back to the underlying issues, I'm primarily going to address Mr. Hines' arguments that the court improperly granted our SPS's amended motion for summary judgment on its foreclosure counterclaim, and the argument that the court improperly denied Mr. Hines' plea to abate the case based on alleged issues related to Locke Lord's representation of Deutsche Bank and SPS's capacity to represent Deutsche Bank as well in the amended motion for summary judgment. As to the affirmative defenses on the counterclaim for judicial foreclosure, all of those have essentially been addressed by Mr. McElroy because the affirmative defenses are payment and quasi-estoppel, which both are grounded in Mr. Hines' argument that he's entitled to the insurance proceeds. Because he is not entitled to the insurance proceeds, and because the court affirmatively held that he's not entitled to the insurance proceeds, his affirmative defenses necessarily fail as well. As far as the plea and abatement, Mr. Hines argues that Locke Lord, which is the my firm which represents SPS, lacked authority to file the amended motion for summary judgment on behalf of SPS because it had not entered an appearance and not obtained a substitution of counsel to represent Deutsche Bank. That's incorrect for a couple of reasons. First, Locke Lord filed the amended motion for summary judgment as counsel for SPS, which it had capacity to do. SPS was seeking foreclosure on behalf of Deutsche Bank in its capacity as mortgage servicer, which it had capacity to do under both the Texas Property Code and its servicing agreement with Deutsche Bank. Even if there were any issues with any of the capacities of Locke in filing the amended motion for summary judgment, Mr. Hines failed to preserve any error related to that because he did not challenge the authority of Locke Lord to act under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 12, which would require a verified motion to challenge the authority of Locke Lord to act on behalf of its client. And unless the court has any other questions, I'll surrender the rest of my time.
It's not. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Well, it was an interesting case because I was fighting two different parties, both of whom claimed they were representing Deutsche Bank. I did what I thought was required, and that is I filed a motion to abate. I filed a plea and abatement. I said, because what his client said is they filed a traditional motion for summary judgment and in a footnote said that they were representing Deutsche Bank. They never filed a motion to, there was never a motion to withdraw filed by either the other attorney that was representing Deutsche Bank before by Ackerman's firm. There was no motion to substitute them as counsel. And so I said, well, unless the rules of civil procedure change somehow, I think that you have to do that sort of thing. And so I asked that that happen, and I asked that at the time of the hearing that it be abated to determine who actually had the right to determine. And so what happens, though, is court overrules that. That's another point on our appeal, is that there was error in overruling our plea and abatement. Goes ahead and hears the motion that is most traditional motion for summary judgment, which I did respond to, filed by his client. And that's the motion upon which the court granted foreclosure. And that was an issue as to did they have a right to represent them or not. It was never addressed. It just was denied. Now, I don't think it's a minor thing. I think that it should have been addressed by the trial court. I don't think it was meaningless, and I certainly did everything I knew to do under the rules to challenge their authority. And I asked them who.
I was just going to say, it seems like a phone call might have been in order.
I did. I talked to him, and I, as I say, the only thing I got was a footnote. That's the only thing that the court got, is that we're here and we're doing it. So I responded to it. So who was I supposed to respond to? I don't think as an attorney I have to guess. I think that was the court's obligation to make a determination as to who had authority to represent Deutsche Bank. Didn't happen. In this particular instance, if the argument is so about, well, gee, you didn't respond to everything in the second motion. I had not one, but two most traditional motions for summary judgment and a no evidence motion for summary judgment. And they said, well, I think what the court could have easily have done is said, okay, if assuming for a moment that we agree that, you know, statute of limitations apply, all of that, could have granted a partial summary judgment. That doesn't have anything to do with our right to proceed on our causes of action. Where we're saying that there's definite error is in the no evidence motion, so that this court, could certainly say, okay, they're entitled to partial summary judgment, but we reverse on the no evidence motion. giving him an opportunity to give him his day in trial, and that's what we didn't have. We raised a scintilla of evidence on everything. I don't know what else we need to do. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Nels. Thank you to all parties here, attorneys. Very well briefed and argued. We appreciate your presence, and your case is submitted.